This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The FCC is moving forward with plans to reinstate a set of regulations called net neutrality. The rules aim to prevent internet service providers from slowing or blocking some online services while prioritizing others. Their latest proposal would bring back many of the same net neutrality rules that were adopted back in 2015 under the Obama administration, but then repealed by the FCC under former President Trump. Current FCC Chair Jessica Rosenworcel announced the plan last month. The first draft of the proposal was approved by the FCC board earlier this month in a 3-2 party line vote.
So if your broadband provider mucks up your traffic, messes around with your ability to go where you want and do what you want online, you can't just pick up and take your business to another provider. That provider may be the only game in town. You need a referee on the field looking out for the public interest and ensuring that access is fast, open, and fair.
Republicans and telecoms groups have criticized net neutrality as regulatory overreach that they say is unnecessary. It's the latest in an ongoing debate over broadband oversight, and it raises questions about how the internet has operated with and without net neutrality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want these net neutrality rules for internet providers back in place? Why or why not? Do you think the internet should be treated like a utility, or should it be left to an open market? What questions do you have about this long-running debate? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Christopher Terry is an associate professor of media ethics and law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. He's a Wisconsin native who's a graduate of UW-Oshkosh, UW-Milwaukee, and UW-Madison. Christopher, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me.
In basic terms, what is net neutrality?
Net neutrality is a term that was coined by Columbia professor Tim Wu to describe the regulation of network management practices. More simply, it covers three basic provisions. It prevents your internet service provider from blocking content it doesn't want you to have, reducing speed or access to content it might not want you to have a lot, or prioritizing its own content. So lots of cable companies that provide internet service also own media companies, and directing you to their content at a higher speed, which is called paid prioritization.
Since net neutrality was overturned under the Trump administration, do we know, have internet service providers been doing that stuff, slowing down or green lighting different online things, different websites, services?
Well, there's two things. Number one, net neutrality did not go away with the Trump administration under Ajit Pai at the FCC moving regulation back to Title I. What happened was is that you took away the federal regulation of that. And in the absence of that, many states, including most notably California, implemented their own net neutrality rules when the FCC stepped out of the way. So it's not correct. And there's a lot of discussion of this, that net neutrality wasn't necessary because it hasn't, nothing bad happened in the intervening years. But it's not true that net neutrality wasn't in place. It just wasn't in place at the federal level.
Is it possible for internet service providers not in one of those states to do these things, to slow down or speed up internet? Or is it such a, you know, global market that if they can't do it in California, they don't do it anywhere?
Well, there are 14, sometimes counted as 18 states that have a similar provision to California's. California's is the only one that was tested in court. That's why that one gets the most credit. But yes, your internet service provider can block you from any content it doesn't want you to have. And the idea that net neutrality, there's never been a need for it. It was actually blocking by Comcast that led to the initial legal dispute over net neutrality back in 2008 and 2009.
Can you talk a little bit about the arguments under the Trump administration and a Republican, then Republican-led FCC to get rid of net neutrality?
Well, what the agency did under the Trump administration is they moved regulation out of Title II and back to Title I. And what that means is that what what the conservatives would call a light touch regulatory approach, there were some provisions that ISPs had to comply with. There was a transparency requirement. There was some disclosure requirements on when and how they would throttle content. But what's really different about what the PI-led FCC did during the Trump administration is that the agency actually argued against a rule that was being upheld in court, and that would be the Title II rule that was passed under the Obama administration in 2015.
We are talking about net neutrality. Christopher Terry is with us from the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this debate for years, over a decade, actually? You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Christopher, as I understand it, part of the core argument here is, you know, what is broadband? Is it an information service? Is it a telecommunication service? Is it a utility? Can you talk about some of these fundamental conceptual debates over how and if we regulate these?
Sure. Under Title II, which is what the FCC is trying to move back to with this latest action, broadband is treated as a common carrier. Common carrier, most easily understood by your audience, is probably the old school traditional on-the-wall phone line, where your internet service provider can make money by delivering content to and from you as the consumer, but really can't discriminate against the content that moves through that system. They can't make any decisions about what that content is, assuming that content is legal. Under Title I, which is the information service approach, the FCC more or less stays out of that equation. And what happens there is that the providers have more control over their own networks. And that gives them the ability to make decisions to block, throttle, or prioritize content.
If I'm an internet consumer with a service provider that does do this stuff, slows down this content over there that they're not making money on, speeds up this content that they do make money on, am I going to feel the difference? Am I going to notice it?
Very much so. In fact, about halfway through this process, after the second court case, which was Verizon's challenge to the FCC's second set of net neutrality rules, there was a short period of time after that decision where streaming services, like especially, but also including Netflix, were being throttled by providers. And it was noticeable at the time. If your content is being throttled, you will notice it very quickly.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was wondering what the guests thoughts were on revisiting Section 230 of the Federal Communications Act in relation to liable by internet service providers about putting forth information that's potentially knowingly false, harmful, or dangerous, and what his thoughts are on. I am in favor of revisiting this issue. I think we've moved quickly, and it's time to revisit it.
Chris, thanks for the call. Christopher, as I understand it, Section 230 is a big internet law issue. Is it tangential to this net neutrality, or is there a stronger connection than I think?
Well, lots of people are trying to draw a connection between those two things, but they're not closely related. Section 230 is an element of the Telecommunications Act that protects platforms, by that I mean websites, for content that's posted by third parties. So in the caller's hypothetical, an internet service provider that is posting its own content that is defamatory and he said libel, but in defamatory terms, the internet service provider doesn't have any protection for that. What it does have protection is if I, you, or the caller posts something on Facebook, Twitter, I'm sorry, X, or what have you, that is defamatory. So if I defame you in some way, Rob, I commit libel against you online, the platform where I post that is not liable for the content that I post. And that's an entirely separate legal issue. I'd be happy to come on a different day to discuss in detail if you'd like.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Christopher, this net neutrality issue doesn't inherently seem like something that should be a Republican, Democratic debate. And yet, we have these party line votes of Democratic and Republican appointees moving it one way or and then the other. Why has this become a partisan issue at the FCC and beyond?
Well, I don't really understand that, because the entire debate started during the Bush administration, when Michael Powell, who is now actually arguing against net neutrality rules in his position with the NCTA, but he was the one who advocated for the first set of net neutrality rules, which were called the four principles. And it's really very much become sort of a partisan issue, but I don't understand why. It's really a consumer protection issue at its core.
We're talking to University of Minnesota media ethics and law professor Christopher Terry about net neutrality rules, what's happened since they were repealed at the federal level, what could change if they're brought back. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the net neutrality back and forth over the last bunch of years? What do you think? How do you feel about your internet service provider now? Do you have accessible high-speed internet where you are in the first place? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Christopher Terry, Associate Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota. We're talking to him about the internet regulations known as net neutrality. They were repealed at the federal level during the Trump administration. Now the FCC under President Biden is working to bring those regulations back. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about this idea of net neutrality? What questions do you have for our expert? Do you feel like you see that sometimes where something is faster online? Certain services say other things are slower than you might expect. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Christopher, I want to add another element in here, and we heard this from the FCC commissioner earlier. The idea that, in effect, for a lot of people, the market is not an answer to this problem. They may not, if they feel like their services are being throttled, they can't just move to another business. They might only have one or maybe two options.
Yes, that's a significant part of what Commissioner Rosenworcel is trying to put forward. I think one thing that never gets mentioned when it comes to net neutrality is that part of what goes on is we make a Title II reference as simple as net neutrality. What the FCC is trying to do this time is actually resolve some unresolved broadband regulatory issues, including the competition issue. There is not very much competition in places in the United States. In fact, in most places, you don't have two high-speed providers as options. You might have a high-speed and a close to high-speed. But in many places, there's only one, and in still a significant part of the United States, there's none. And that issue is tied back to the debate over net neutrality. When the FCC lost the ability to enforce net neutrality in the Comcast decision in 2010, it undermined the FCC's authority to implement the National Broadband Plan.
Did the Obama-era regulations on net neutrality fix or change that after that court ruling?
Well, for the short period of time they were in place, right, it did give the FCC some authority to move forward. But part of the issue that we see right now is the Biden administration has allocated quite a bit of money to resolve broadband gaps, and the FCC even has to wrestle with people that it's trying to give money to implement broadband, because it doesn't have all of the necessary authority that it wants or probably could use under Title I, which is part of what the FCC is trying to do with the move back to Title II.
The FCC provisionally approved this 3-2 vote we mentioned earlier. These kind of federal regulations, they are not a one-step process. What would happen from now on to bring net neutrality back into place at the federal level?
Well, they haven't provisionally approved it. They approved the decision to decide whether or not they're actually going to do it.
Gotcha.
They are currently taking comments. The comment period extends into December. I don't know exactly what will happen if the government shuts down. But in early December, the FCC will take a first round of comments out of a docket, examine what those decisions, what those comments say. It may modify the rule at that point, and at some point, 60 to 90 days after that, it will propose a new rule, a new version of what it proposed a couple weeks ago. There'll be another round of comments, and then 60 to 90 days after that, we might see the final rule, which would then take another 60 to 90 days to implement.
The comment process itself has been controversial in the past. Under the Trump administration, FCC commissioners pointed toward a lot of comments against net neutrality. It emerged later that a lot of those weren't actual human people making those comments. Can you take us back to what we found out then?
Sure. Initially, with the Title II order in 2015, the FCC took in about 3.5 million comments, public comments. A lot of those were just sort of emails or whatever. A lot of it was driven by John Oliver's segment on net neutrality. When the FCC went to repeal the Title II order under the Trump administration, there was some astroturfing of comments. In fact, someone used my name and address to file a comment against net neutrality, as did for Mickey Mouse and all sorts of other types of people. There's some assessments that that commenting scheme generated as many as 16 million comments, about two-thirds of which are just fake.
Talking to Christopher Terry, Associate Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota, talking about the years-long back and forth in net neutrality when it comes to broadband internet, the FCC moving to bring it back, early stages there. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Is there still action going on at the state level, Christopher? Are you seeing more states moving to join California and others with their own net neutrality rules?
There were several states that were looking at it, but I think they're kind of playing the wait and see game now, because the federal regulation, if it does go back on the books and survives the judicial review, would preempt the state law, including California's, ironically.
Now here, of course, we're talking about the United States. What are we seeing the rest of the world do when it comes to issues of net neutrality?
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. European regulators are arguing over it. In the UK, they're having a significant debate over whether or not net neutrality should apply. Some countries, it's just sort of built into how their internet system works, because they don't have quite as commercial of media system as we do here in the U.S.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, I was wondering how this future net neutrality law would affect me. For example, is I recently purchased the Hulu, Disney, ESPN bundle, but my carrier, Charter, won't let me get the ESPN unless I buy the upgrade TV app to play ESPN. But it's all, I'm paying for ones and zeros. What's the difference between the ones and zeros of Disney or Hulu and the ones and zeros of ESPN? I don't get why they're allowed to charge me extra for ones, other different ones and zeros.
Mike, thanks for the call. Christopher, does this tap into the net neutrality argument?
Yes, but also involves the a la carte cable argument. The short answer for the caller is that if there are provisions on the books that says your internet service provider cannot dictate any terms on which your content moves back and forth to you, as it could not under common carrier, it would not be able to charge you the extra part for that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. Now, Christopher, when net neutrality came into place, I think there were dire predictions that it would hurt the market, hurt the companies that provide internet services, ultimately hurt our services in the long run. When net neutrality was repealed, at least at the federal level, as you mentioned, it's still in place at the state level, arguments that this would be a disaster for the internet. I mean, are both sides over-exaggerating the impacts of going back and forth on this?
Yes, very much so. The chief argument for Title II that I think, and I'm a strong supporter of net neutrality in sort of in concept, is that it assesses one set of regulations that everyone in the telecommunications world clearly understands. It's a federal system. It's been around since the 1930s. Everybody understands what the rules are. There are some concerns about the rate regulations and stuff, and the FCC has provided some forbearance in this proposed set of rules for that. But This is an issue that, I mean, I think I said the day that the announcement was made, it was like a classic hit station of all the same old rhetoric has been put back out, because it very much has. And it's a very heated issue over a very nerdy regulatory position.
Now we see changes under a Democratic president, reversed under a Republican, now maybe going back the other way. Is this a case where Congress ultimately could step in and say, okay, we're going to clarify what we want on this part of telecommunications regulation and put an end to the debate for a while?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think for all the finger pointing we have back and forth at the FCC, fingers should be pointed at Congress. The issue wasn't really well understood at the beginning of this debate, but after the Verizon decision, when the national broadband plan was basically derailed 21 days after it was launched, Congress should have gotten involved one way or the other and just provided clarity. Until Congress tells the FCC what to do, the FCC is, whether you agree with Title I or Title II, it is trying to apply old regulation to a system that it doesn't have a lot of guidance on what Congress wants it to do. As an administrative agency, the FCC can only really do what it's told, and it's trying to do that right now.
In our last few moments, Christopher, if people feel strongly about this, how do they get in touch with the FCC during this comment period?
The FCC's website has the electronic comment filing system. Do a search for the net neutrality docket, and you can easily file a comment there right online. It's a very simple form.
Christopher, thanks again for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
That's Christopher Terry, Associate Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. He's with us today for a look at why the FCC is looking to bring back net neutrality rules at the federal level, what it could mean for the way we use the internet. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You've most likely seen the news. Last Wednesday, an attacker shot and killed 18 people and wounded 13 others at a bowling alley and bar in Lewiston, Maine. On Friday, after a two-day manhunt, the suspect was found dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. His motives for the shooting aren't entirely clear at this point. Law enforcement is still completing an investigation. Authorities say, though, that it was likely linked to paranoia. The assailant was committed to a mental health facility after making threats of violence during an Army Reserve training exercise near West Point, New York, back in July. A statewide awareness alert was sent out in September after he made more threats against his base and fellow soldiers. Law enforcement visited his home for a welfare check but never located him. Since these details have emerged, a lot of focus has been placed on his mental health history. But our next guest says it's important not to stigmatize mental health issues in the aftermath of mass violence. Here's Maine's Department of Public Safety Commissioner Michael Soschuk speaking at a press conference at Lewiston City Hall on Saturday.
Something that's incredibly important for us to say and for me to say, and I find myself saying it on a regular basis, just because there's appears to be a mental health nexus to this scenario, the vast, vast, vast majority of people, the vast majority of people with a mental health diagnosis will never hurt anybody.
Our next guest is a psychiatrist who helps patients with serious mental illness. She's been at the forefront of educating healthcare providers in how to prevent firearm violence because she says gun violence is more than a political problem in this country. It's also a public health crisis. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of when you see a focus on mental health when we talk about mass shootings and other forms of gun violence? Are there changes in laws you'd like to see? Red flag laws, for example. Do you have questions about where mental illness and firearm access run into each other? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy Barnhorst is an inpatient and emergency psychiatrist, the vice chair for community mental health at the University of California Davis Department of Psychiatry, and associate director of the California Firearms Violence Research Center. She's also the director of the Bullet Points Project, a state-funded effort to develop a firearm violence prevention curriculum for healthcare providers. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
As an expert in firearm law and mental illness, what's been going through your mind as you watch and read media coverage of the tragic shootings in Lewiston?
It's so horrible to see this happen yet again. And it's not surprising that, of course, the mental illness angle has been brought up, as it often is. In the case of this man, it does seem like he was experiencing some symptoms, possibly of a serious mental illness, some paranoia, maybe hearing voices. And in addition to that, he had been hospitalized, it seems like, for some time this summer. And so there's all these questions, as there often are, like, how could a guy like this, who clearly had some mental health problems and had been making threats, how was he able to legally own a bunch of guns? And this is something that comes up over and over again. And I think it really gets to this idea of, what do we want to do preventatively in the future? And are we going to target his firearm access? Are we going to target the mental health system? And where do we put the onus on making some changes so that this doesn't keep happening?
As we heard from the Maine Department of Public Safety there, the overwhelming majority of people with diagnosable mental health conditions will not commit an act of violence. And if I correct me if I'm wrong, many people who commit acts of violence don't have a diagnosable mental health connection. It's not so easy as to say we could solve gun violence by targeting mental health. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, as a psychiatrist who works in a very a system with very scarce resources, I would be a traitor to my people to say, oh, we don't need any more bolstering of the mental health system. We absolutely do. We should be putting a lot of money into getting more facilities stood up, more systems, resources for people, more psychiatrists, more social workers, more therapists. I mean, the mental health system needs a lot of support in shoring up. However, I don't think that is an effective way to prevent violence, the preponderance of which in the United States is community violence that happens in the context of, you know, domestic violence, neighborhoods that have high levels of poverty, people of color in the context of crimes. It's not mostly mass shootings, even though that's often what many Americans worry about happening to them. Most people who have a serious mental illness are just trying to get by and get to their appointments and keep their housing and get their medications refilled. They're not perpetrating these acts of violence. And like you mentioned, the majority of people who perpetrate these acts of violence don't have a diagnosable or treatable mental illness. But occasionally there is some overlap there. And then, you know, folks often do associate mental illness with mass shootings.
Now, in states around the country, we've seen different versions of what people call red flag laws, the idea that under certain circumstances, under certain procedures, and it varies from place to place, we can remove guns from the hands of the possession of people who were worried about committing an act of violence. Can you talk about some broad strokes, what these laws are and what they try to do?
Yeah, I helped actually work on the development of the law here in California, which we passed in 2014 in the wake of the Isla Vista shooting. And in the subsequent, you know, 5 to 10 years, there's been a number of other ones passed, mostly in the wake of mass shootings, because what was repeatedly happening was somebody who had firearms, often owned them legally or purchased them legally, got on the radar of the police for making threats, behaving erratically, doing things that people perceived as potentially very dangerous, including things like uploading videos, essentially saying on YouTube that they were going to perpetrate some sort of act of mass violence. The problem is, if the person hasn't committed a crime and they're not really clearly meeting the relatively stringent criteria to be involuntarily psychiatrically hospitalized, there's not much police can do. And in Isla Vista here in California, what we saw was that the police went to this guy's house and talked to him because his parents were concerned, other people were concerned about him. And he presented as very well put together. He said, oh, I've been having a hard time, but everything's fine. There was no evidence that any crime had been committed. He didn't appear to be mentally ill. He didn't have a mental health history that would have justified some sort of hospitalization. And so the police had no recourse. There was really nothing they could do. This also happened with Parkland, that that guy was on their radar and they knew about him. People were afraid of him, but he wasn't somebody who was arrestable. He wasn't somebody who was committable to a psychiatric hospital. And So we kind of fell through this gap between the mental health system and the criminal justice system. And that's where these red flag laws come in, is that they allow police or family members, in some states, other people as well, to petition to have somebody's guns removed, not because they've committed a crime or not because they appear to be mentally ill, but because they appear to be dangerous. And it really stands on that. And they can work very quickly. So you don't have to wait for a mental health professional to do a long evaluation and diagnose the person and get them into a hospital. Police oftentimes can get an order from a judge over the phone and get the guns out of a threatening situation, or other people can petition for an order with the court and it can be approved and served within, you know, hours or days.
Then, and I think this is something that concerns people who advocate for the Second Amendment and gun rights. As I understand it, there's usually a procedure. If my guns, say, have been taken under these circumstances, there are ways for me to petition to say, no, I am perfectly capable of handling them. What would be the next step in that situation?
Yeah, absolutely. A really good point. So it's not like, you know, anyone can just take your guns away for any reason that they feel a little unease. There is a legal process. Due process is in place. So the respondent to the order within 2 weeks will go to court. They will give the judge their side of the story and say, like, oh, you know, hey, I was having a bad time, or I made those statements, but I didn't mean them. And the judge gets a chance to hear the evidence from both sides and then can potentially return the person's firearms if they don't believe that the person continues to be a threat. And here in California, the research that's been done at the center where I work has shown that a lot of these orders, there was an emergency order issued, but then the final order that would happen after that hearing where the respondent got a chance to plead their case, the firearms were returned and the order was lifted. So either, you know, the crisis period had passed in the 2 weeks, or the person wasn't quite as dangerous or threatening as they initially presented. So they don't always go to a longer term order, and even the longer term orders can last months, sometimes up to years with renewals, but it's a civil order. It's not something on your criminal record. It doesn't involve a psychiatric hospitalization. So in some ways it does, with due process in place, it does target people's Second Amendment rights. But one of the things I like about it is that it only targets those rights, and it only targets them temporarily. It doesn't, you know, go on your criminal record. Again, it doesn't involuntarily put you in a hospital and take you out of your home and your community and your job and your social support. It just removes the firearms from a crisis situation with the option of you getting them back.
We're talking to Amy Barnhorst, inpatient and emergency psychiatrist, vice chair for community mental health at the University of California Davis Department of Psychiatry, director of the Bullet Points Project. We're talking about the overlap, the intersection of mental health and firearm violence prevention, as well as red flag and other laws after last week's mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you think states like Wisconsin should have red flag laws in place? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Amy Barnhorst, expert on firearms law and mental illness, who helped develop California's red flag law and has testified before state legislatures on these issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we could talk about mental health concerns and guns and firearm violence without going into harmful stereotypes or stigmas? Are you a healthcare provider who works with patients who have mental illness? And do you have questions for our guest about her work helping clinicians understand firearm violence prevention? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I'm just, I would say it should be a federally passed law. A red flag law would be awesome for the nation. If someone has the means to carry out their threats and they make the threats and friends and family, neighbors, community realize that this person has made these threats and yet they have the means to carry them out, whether they purchase the guns legally or illegally, they should definitely have them taken away.
Thanks for the call, Brian, at 800-642-1234. Now, in Wisconsin, we don't have a red flag law right now. Amy, could you talk about efforts to bring them into more states? And as Brian was saying, to have a red flag law, stronger ones at the federal level?
Yeah, and this has been really a big push. I mean, when California passed it, there were only two other laws like this in the country, but they were much more limited in scope. And then since the unfortunate number of mass shootings that happened since 2014, we've seen 21 states and Washington, D.C. all pass these laws. And there have been a lot of calls to have a federal red flag law and many other states that have worked on their laws. I know Wisconsin has really put some effort into thinking about putting one together, but hasn't quite, you know, made it happen yet. And in fact, Maine has something that's sort of halfway there, but not quite there. And that has really been called into question after this last shooting. What they did was, rather than really going for a red flag law that was specific to somebody who was making threats or exhibiting dangerous behavior that could happen very quickly with very few barriers to take the guns out of the equation, Maine passed what's now being called a yellow flag law because it's tied to their blue paper of psychiatric commitment. So the blue paper is the application to have somebody brought in involuntarily to a mental health hospital. You can also file a yellow paper, hence the name yellow flag law, with that blue paper. But in order to have the firearms removed, you have to have a mental health provider involved that can certify, do an evaluation and certify that the person is dangerous. So, you know, this is problematic if anyone here has ever tried to get an appointment with a mental health provider or get them to do an evaluation. There's a huge shortage across the country, and particularly in Maine, there's not beds, there's not people, there's not, you know, resources to do this. And it just puts this barrier, both a psychological barrier and a temporal one. So if you're a law enforcement officer, rather than just calling a judge on the phone to get the order to remove the firearms, now you have to bring the person in, you have to wait until they can see a mental health practitioner, that person can do an evaluation, more paper gets submitted to the court. It's just a much more arduous process. And you can imagine that it's not going to be quite as effective as something that can happen very quickly in a very serious situation when somebody like this guy is making threats to do something terrible.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Marilyn joins us now in Neenah. Marilyn, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Marilyn, or tell us about?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, I'm definitely supporting big restrictions. I worked in behavioral health in Wisconsin and firsthand know that if a psychiatrist is feeling somebody's not safe to be discharged, if a judge finds them competent, they can be discharged against medical advice. And we have been, you know, I have known personally in many scary situations. Psychiatrist is feeling it's not a good, if they were another psychiatrist would have to give the permission instead of a judge that, you know, really is doesn't have that hands-on interpretation of behavioral health. Anyhow, we need much stronger rules and laws, and there's all kinds of areas that need to be tightened up to protect our society, in my personal experience.
Marilyn, thanks for the call. Marilyn cut out a little bit there, but I think we got the gist for the most part. Amy, what do you think about what Marilyn brought up?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Marilyn. And always nice to hear from other healthcare professionals. That same thing has happened to me where I think someone's really dangerous, but it is out of my hands and a judge thinks differently and releases the person. And admittedly, sometimes they release the person, not because they think they're not dangerous, but here in California, your dangerousness has to be due to a mental illness for you to stay in a psychiatric hospital. We're not a perfect solution for everybody who's a threat. We're just a way to treat the people who are posing a threat because they have a mental illness. So if the person is just, you know, wanting to hurt their neighbor who's having an affair with their wife or kill their ex-boss who fired them, that's not due to a mental illness. And so the judge might release that person regardless of how dangerous they are. And this is exactly how I got involved with the crafting of California's red flag law in the first place, was I wanted something that I and law enforcement and others could use as a stopgap measure for those people who do fall through those cracks.
Thanks for that call, Marilyn, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Amy Barnhorst, Vice Chair for Community Mental Health at the University of California, Davis, Department of Psychiatry, talking about gun violence and mental health. Amy, I want to get into some of the other elements of work you are doing, working with healthcare providers on gun violence prevention. What kind of things are you hoping that healthcare providers can do?
Well, one of the things we've found is that healthcare providers really want to be part of the solution to the big public health problem that is gun violence in the United States, but it's not something that's taught in most medical training programs. And many of our patients do rely on us for information about safety and keeping, you know, their household healthy and safe in addition to themselves. But, you know, we're limited by things like time and knowledge and our training. And so the state of California actually passed a bill to fund this program that I run to develop a curriculum to teach mental health care and medical health care providers how to assess patients who are at risk of firearm injury and then intervene with them, usually, you know, hopefully in ways that are voluntary and time limited and collaborative. So, for example, if you are seeing a patient in your family practice clinic and you know, they have a bad breakup, they're drinking more, they're having sort of fleeting thoughts of suicide, but, you know, they're not somebody who merits going to an inpatient psychiatric hospital or something more extreme like that. But this is somebody that might be at risk of, in a time where they're more intoxicated, and if they're a firearm owner, they might be at risk of, you know, making a suicide attempt with their gun. And so having a conversation with them about putting some time and space between that them and their firearms in the crisis period, you know, until things have resolved, until some time has passed, is something we teach healthcare providers how to do. So it's not, you know, it's not about getting into people's business about their firearms. It's about really assessing who might be at risk and how can you help them the way we talk to patients about so many risks about their health and their life. How can we talk to them about their access to firearms or the access to firearms of their, you know, kid who's going through a struggle or their mother-in-law who lives with them and is now having some paranoia due to her dementia? And what can we do to keep the household safe?
Now that's for patients who come in to talk to that healthcare provider. Do you have thoughts on ways that, you know, healthcare providers can do public health outreach in the communities to get these messages, even to the people who might not show up in their offices?
Yeah, that's a great question because so many people don't have good access to healthcare. I think really thinking about this as a public health problem and not about, you know, good and bad, right or wrong, Democrat or Republican, thinking about, you know, firearms are a way of life for many Americans. And one in three or more homes in the U.S. has a firearm in it. And so how do we reach people who do have firearms and just make sure that they're aware of some of the risks and the ways they can mitigate those risks by storing them safely, making sure that people who shouldn't have access to them or people who are in crisis in their household don't have access to them during those times? And kind of treating this like a public health problem, the way we treat things like motor vehicle crashes or cigarette smoking or diet as a public health problem. And physicians aren't, you know, the entirety of the solution here, but I think we can be really important messengers.
As you mentioned, mass shootings like the one in Maine last week are dramatic. They get a lot of attention. They're not the majority of shootings, though. Do you see ways to reach out to other causes of of homicide in particular in this case that aren't the mass shootings that might make the headlines?
Yeah, and really the majority of firearm deaths in the U.S. are suicide. In fact, in Maine in particular, Maine has a very low homicide rate, but their suicide rate is pretty high. 85% of their firearm deaths are suicides in that state. So I think it's really important to have people know that because in some of the work I've done with firearm owners and you know, shooting instructors and ranges and gun shops, I've learned that most people who are firearm owners take safety very seriously. You know, they're very good about teaching, whether it's their students or their members or their kids, that you have to be really, really careful when you're handling a firearm. But what folks don't seem to talk about as much, and I think this is true, you know, in general, they don't talk about suicide as much. It's a stigmatized topic. It's something that makes people uncomfortable. And people didn't seem to be as aware about the risks of firearms in suicide as they were about the risks of, for example, unintentional injury. I think it's also important to talk about the risks of having a firearm around when you're in some time of interpersonal crisis. You know, I think we all can imagine being driven to the point where we, you know, things got really bad and we wanted to do something terrible. And most of us wouldn't act on that. But sometimes people become really pushed over the edge. They become disinhibited because of drugs or alcohol, or even occasionally, you know, decreased mental capacity. And for those people to have access to a gun during those times, it can really lead to an increased risk of homicide. So just kind of that idea of like, it's not, you know, guns all the time or no guns ever. It's kind of, you know, let's get them away from folks who are in crisis, who are high risk, and work together to make that a collaborative process that is something people can actually talk about and work together on.
Amy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Amy Barnhorst, inpatient and emergency psychiatrist, vice chair for community mental health at the UC Davis Department of Psychiatry. Been looking at red flag laws and the intersection between mental health and firearms as the country mourns 18 lives lost in the Lewiston mass shooting that was last week. On Friday, we had a fun conversation leading up to Halloween about our favorite scary movies. A lot of you called in. Some more joined in after the show by email. Peter from Eden writes, I'm 70 now. When I was about 8, I watched Frankenstein starring Boris Karloff. Was sitting quite close to our black and white TV when the monster's face suddenly filled the screen. I screamed and hid under the dining room table. The rest of my family thought that was hilarious. Thanks for the story, Peter. Dave in Madison mentions The Exorcist. Sharon says the scariest movie we've ever watched was Wait Until Dark with Audrey Hepburn. The build up of suspense was intense. The whole movie audience jumped and screamed when the attacker jumped at her in the dark house. Nerves jangled for hours. I will say, Sharon, back in the day when I was in high school band camp, they showed that to us. You know, a bunch of surly Gen X teenagers were like, yeah, old movie, whatever. All of us jumped and screamed at the exact moment you're talking about. I'm surprised, you know, nobody alerted the authorities with all the screaming teenagers at band camp. Keep sharing your favorite scary movies. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time.